Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What has happened to the once booming border city of Juarez in the Mexican state of Chihuahua, and what toll has the raging violence there taken on the city's large population of undereducated and underemployed youth? Last year, more than 3,000 people were killed in this city of about 1.5 million, and some experts predict the total number of murders could approach 5,000 by the end of 2011. My guest today has spent a great deal of time in the world's most violent city, working to document the consequences of that violence and to understand the lives of those who find themselves at greatest risk. Photojournalist Dominic Bracco is a grant recipient from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting, and his work has appeared in major newspapers, including The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post. He returns to his alma mater, the University of Texas at Arlington, this week to mount a three-month exhibition of his work entitled Life and Death in the Northern Pass. Dominic, welcome to Think.
Hey, thanks for having me.
What made you want to cover Juarez?
I grew up on the border, and so I always knew I wanted to go back there to work. I had spent some time traveling elsewhere, and the war had actually already started when I was in college. So I was always reading about it, and my parents would tell me, you know, this is going on. And as a photographer, it kind of felt natural to go back and start working there.
Having grown up on the border myself, it's funny because you always know people who live on both sides. And for the longest time, it was such a porous border, aside from any sort of official thing. People just came and went and went about their business sort of on both sides.
Right. I mean, I remember turning 16 and driving to Mexico right away, you know.
Kind of a rite of passage.
Exactly.
We won't talk about what you did there.
But, you know, it was just a natural thing. You know, you have family, everybody, it doesn't matter, you know, who you are, but everybody has some tie to Mexico if you're living on the border. And so, it, like you said, it's really natural. Everybody was going back and forth. And so you hear when something's happening in Mexico on the border, it's hits close to home because it's people that you know, are being affected.
So your focus has been on the young people known as los nini, ni trabajo ni escuela. How does that translate?
So basically it's about nini are people that don't work or go to school. So I always say there's basically two options in Juarez for a kid. If you're a poor kid growing up in Juarez, you're either going to go to work in a factory making $50 a week like your parents, or you're going to become a nautical mm-hmm. and live a short life. And so those that do nothing have kind of chosen the alternative, and they just would rather do nothing than become a nautical and die. But they're also the ones that are on that path. You know, they're the most susceptible to violence and becoming the next killers.
And there's a really large population of young people there, like a huge number of people between, what, like 14 and 24?
Right. There's a large population of young people, but they're also now the ones that are really feeding into this, because you would see early on that the killings were happening to older people. Now, you know, it's very common to see, you know, a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old, up to 20 years old getting killed. It's more normal to see that almost than seeing someone that's 35 or older.
So are these people just fatalistic? Do they expect that they will die by 21 or 25?
They do. Actually, I heard this guy once tell me a really interesting way about thinking about living in Juarez. He told me there's two ways about thinking of living here. You either go on every day living in fear, being afraid, or you just go on living and basically wait until the day that you die. Hmm. And that is, I mean, it's a very fatalistic way of looking at it. But
so how are people trying to protect themselves who may not be directly involved with the drug industry?
Well, that's the thing that I think is the most important for people to understand, is that it doesn't matter who you are. If you're living in Juarez, you're going to be affected. Because, for example, if you have a store selling chicharrones or whatever on the side of the street, you know, you're probably paying extortion to multiple parties, and you're paying two cartels and sometimes police officers. I mean, they just arrested police and federal police in Juarez for extorting a junkyard. So mm-hmm. Everybody's being affected. If you don't pay, you die. And so there's that reality. So I think people either run away, or they continue living there and they pay the what they call cota. It's an extortion tax. And but what do they do to avoid it? I guess they just try to go on living a normal life as much as they can. You know, they still have parties and they still hang out. And in a way, when you go to Juarez compared to some other parts of Mexico that have been affected recently by violence, it's almost been happening there so long now that there's kind of a desensitization, right? The people, they don't feel as, they feel a little bit of a disconnect, you know? And I've heard people tell me, well, I just stopped watching the news because I just can't deal with it anymore. Because every single day, you know, there's deaths in Juarez pretty much. And so they would almost rather just have their kids not pay attention to what's going on, you know, than live with it like that.
Well, and when you have 10 or 12 murders a day, it almost stops being newsworthy in the same way that it would normally have been in a city of that size.
Right. It's oftentimes, you know, people say if the death toll's, you know, just one or two, it's not really that big of a deal. Hmm. You know, here's two little deaths, you know. But if it's more than five, then maybe it takes notice. And if it's a bunch of kids, then maybe it takes notice. And it's kind of horrible to be thinking in that sense, but that's the reality of the place.
So let's talk about media coverage outside what you've been doing, and we'll get specifically to your work in just a minute here. But how much of a chilling effect has there been based on the fact that journalists have, in fact, been killed, including a photography intern for El Diario Juarez?
Right. There's a lot of things. Even myself, we don't cover certain things. You know, if there's something that is feels like it's too close to the criminal organized crime, then you just don't go there. You don't do it. I think daily events in Juarez are accessible. You can still report on them. If there's a murder, you can still go and say there's a murder here. But you cannot go and really ask too many questions. No one really digs too deep. Now, that said, there's some journalists in Juarez that are amazingly brave, and they just keep doing it. And I can't, you know, I have the most respect for them in the world. They're amazing. Even after, you know, two journalists of El Diario have died working there. But in some ways, Juarez is more workable than other areas. Like Tamaulipas and Nuevo León are really hard to work because they're controlled by different cartels, so mm-hmm. it's kind of a different security situation. But even so, everybody kind of knows that there's certain things that you just don't do. You know, you don't ask too many questions that are going to get you in trouble now after they killed El Chaco. And but there's still journalists that do it, and they just keep doing it. You know, just depends on the individual, I think, what they're going to do.
Do you have a set of guidelines for yourself? Like, I'll go and shoot this, but if I don't get a good answer to my first question, I won't ask a follow-up.
That's a good question. I think that my rule is to go with my gut, which sounds kind of silly, but it's what I do. If I feel like someone I'm talking to is not trustworthy, I don't even waste time there because I feel – or I don't – I mean, you use common sense, you know. Mm-hmm. So if somebody is killed and you feel like there's going to be other media there and you can all go and cover it, it's okay. It's safe. But if you show up, for example, to a crime scene really fast and there's no one around, you know, sure, I might wait or I might go take a picture. But you got to be really careful and look around and pay attention to what's going on because you never know who's still there.
You have in this collection some really graphic pictures. And for people who haven't necessarily followed coverage, the standards are really different in Mexico in terms of what you're allowed to shoot as opposed to being kept back 25 feet behind yellow tape. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Actually, in Mexico, you're not allowed to be really close. It's just a matter of being on time, you know, being there when something happens
or waiting.
So, for example, I have there's a picture that I have of a couple that's been killed. She's pregnant, and they're about 18 or mm-hmm. 19 years old. And that took several weeks to get that kind of access to get close enough to take that picture. I became friends with the local rescue team, and they started taking me around, and I worked with them for a while. A lot of times things were so gruesome that you would take pictures, but you just can't give it any dignity, you know? Mm-hmm. The deaths are just so horrifying. But that scene was one of those scenes that, you know, it's a simple, they were killed by one bullet. It's not super graphic, but just the simplicity of it and the fact that they're embracing really makes them feel like humans and gives them dignity. And so the rescue team guys knew that, and when they saw it, they it was just heartbreaking, and they gave me their rescue team jacket, and so I crossed the police line. We actually all got into trouble because of it, but they were willing to make that risk on their jobs because they felt like it was important.
In addition to, you know, it takes you a while with that picture to take your eyes off the couple themselves, but when you sort of let yourself wander around the rest of the frame, you see that the car they're sitting in together is just trashed. It's got, you know, the vinyl seats have been worn away and there's just foam padding. And the undercurrent throughout all of these images, as I've seen them online, is this just extraordinary poverty that's there on top of everything else that these people are having to deal with.
Yeah, I mean... Juarez is a city that costs about 70% of the United States to live in, and most people that live there are making, you know, $200 a month. It's really hard to survive. And so in a lot of ways, it makes sense. They have this huge, you know, this huge influence of drugs there, their proximity to the United States, and then the fact that living there is almost impossible, and it makes sense that people would kind of cross into the illegal activity. But then at the same time, you know, I don't even know, you know, I wasn't able to ask when we were at that scene how these people came to this, like how did they die or why were they killed. You know, for one, there was no one around to ask. Mm-hmm. But also, if they were, I don't really know that I would have asked, just because of safety. But they have, you know, the guy was a working class person. You could tell that from the vehicle because he had, you know, tools, and he was like a window maker or something. And so the glass was in the back of the car, and you could tell that they were a working class couple. And so, yeah.
How often do you have the sense when you arrive on the scene after a crime that the perpetrator might still be around somewhere watching everything in the aftermath?
I think it's a pretty big reality because I've heard of, you know, I have friends that have actually seen them go down, and they'll say, oh, this execution just happened, and they've seen it, and then they've actually seen the killer come back and, you know, park nearby and kind of watch what was going on afterwards. So I think it happens. They also do something what they call rematar, where they go and they re-kill someone. So if somebody, they go do a hit and they, you know, shoot up a car and then they run away, maybe they decide, well, we ran away too fast, so we should go back.
To make sure they're dead. Wow. So you mentioned doing, was it sort of a ride-along system with the rescue team that you were working with?
Yeah, I mean, I just would get up and I kind of became obsessed with it, actually. I would get up and I would go on two shifts in a row, which were 10 hours apiece. So I'd just sleep in the car. But we would drive around and go to these calls. There wasn't, you know, because of the way it works, every person has a zone that they work in. So a lot of times we would go and there would be nothing for 2 or 3 days, you know. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden there would be an amazing, there was a day, I mean, one day where I saw three pregnant couples executions, and it was just ridiculous, you know, the amount of violence at that time. So
my guest is photojournalist Dominic Bracco. He's a recipient of a Pulitzer Center grant for crisis reporting, and he has an exhibition at the University of Texas at Arlington. The exhibition is called Life and Death in the Northern Past. We'll return to our conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call now. 1-800-933-5372 is our number. The email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is photojournalist Dominic Bracco. He's a recipient of a Pulitzer Center grant for crisis reporting. If you would like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. So I want to talk about this. You have been present for some really intimate, terrible moments in people's lives when they are preparing to bury a loved one or visiting the body. How do you form the kinds of relationships that allow people on the worst day of their lives to open up and let you in?
I think people understand what the press is about and what is. So in a way, you can be very honest. You say, you know, I'm here to show, to tell your story. And sometimes that's enough. I never shoot anything that the family's not open to. And so I also approach very slowly. When I began photographing, I'd never rush up and just start shooting. You know, it takes hours, you know, working and slowly taking pictures and getting them used to the camera and you being there until basically they kind of forget that you're there. And they're also going through so much emotion that you're the least of their worries. If you work quietly and slowly enough with respect that they don't really notice you. But you also, you are there and you are human, and you know, if you just show them a little bit of empathy, I think that they feel that and people respond by opening up.
Do they ever want to see the pictures that you've taken of these horrible days?
No, not usually. I can't think of a time when someone's asked me to.
So you are still in your mid-20s, and I would imagine that your youth in some ways is really helpful because you kind of blend in with the people that you're shooting. On the other hand, it sure might look like you belong with some people who have been targeted for violence.
Well, I think it helps me being young because, for example, I hang out with a lot of kids that are basically, you know, 4 or 5 years younger than me. And so they can connect, and we connect in a way that I think a photographer that, you know, is in their 40s or 50s might not be able to as easily. And so I can go in and we can joke around and everything, and I kind of understand what they're going through in a way of, as a young person, not as a person from Juarez, but you kind of get, you know, what it's like being young and, you know, girls and all that kind of thing that's going on with people at, you know, 18 or whatever. And so that helps tremendously, really. I mean, because a lot of times they, you know, they'll ask me questions about life or whatever, and kind of I get questions sometimes that surprise me that they would only ask me, I think, because they think of me as a friend or as a something like that.
Is it strange to you to relate to people? And I know that you've photographed people who have done contract killings for certain amounts of money and have been involved in drug trades. On the one hand, you can relate to them perfectly well around things like music and culture and girls and whatever, and then also realize there's a very big way in which I am not like them.
Of course. And you also have to keep that separation as a journalist. You have to let them know that you're here to do a job as a journalist. And, you know, some photographers will say, like, oh, I'm a fly on the wall. Like, everything I do, I have no influence. But that's ridiculous. I mean, you're there spending long amounts of time with people. And so they're going to want to get to know you if you want to get that kind of access. And so you have to be very open about the fact that, yeah, you're their friend and you respect them and everything. But you're also a journalist. And if they're doing something and you're going to document it, you're going to present it in a way that's honest. So if they're, you know, a bad person, then you showing them as a bad person because you're being honest. And I think I've been able to show them the magazines and newspapers and stuff, and they've luckily been pretty open to it, and they get it. But at the same time, I'm not afraid to tell a kid, like, you shouldn't be doing that, you know. Why don't you think twice about doing that?
Have they been told that before? Like, are their parents wringing their hands and saying, please don't do this? Or does it seem even to the sort of responsible adults like this might be their only option?
It's a case-by-case basis, of course. But generally speaking, their parents work so much just to make it barely. And they are so stressed out about finding a job or, you know, putting bread on the table that sometimes their kids lack the kind of, you know, involvement they need from their parents because their parents are so busy just trying to feed the kid. And so especially when you're already a teenager, you're already an adult in Mexico. You know, at 18, you're thought of as an adult. It's different than the United States. So when you're still kind of hanging around or whatever, you're not as much of a worry, you know. And so I think those kids, no, I don't think they hear it as much as they probably should.
Are there, like, civic programs or, you know, if we had this happening in this country, and I suppose you could argue we do in some places, but not nearly to this extent, there would be programs and you know, concerted efforts to try and redirect their energies.
There are, and there's people that are doing amazing work. One organization that I work with a lot, their name is OPI, and they go out and they get to know these kids, and they kind of, their idea is to break down gang boundaries. So they kind of, you know, when there's, because a lot of the infrastructure of Juarez, criminal infrastructure, is that you have all these neighborhood gangs, and then it kind of grows up into larger organizations. But each neighborhood, you know, that's where it really starts. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the ones selling the drugs on the street. They might be working for a larger cartel, but they still fight each other. It's like East LA or something or whatever, right? So these guys go in and they basically become friends with both sides, and they kind of act as mediators between. It's really cool. And then another one that I just found that's really cool is they're the Azteca Symphony, Youth Symphony. That's what it's called, I think. Azteca Youth Symphony, yeah. And they teach kids how to play music, and they play amazing, seriously better than most high school bands I've listened to in the U.S. And these kids have been playing for 9 months or something, you know. Mm. They at the beginning, they taught for 3 months without instruments. The kids were just learning to read music. Wow. And all this kind of stuff. And so then, you know, 9 months later, they're playing in front of people, and apparently, they brought people to tears. The music is great, and the kids are amazing. And so they have this philosophy, you know, give a kid an instrument instead of a gun, and it's been working. You know, there's people doing good stuff, and it's exciting.
It's like they're just desperate for an outlet.
Because the kids don't have anything to do, mm-hmm. you know. And so if, you know, there, I did a film that I'll be showing. It's about this kid named Esteban. And he was a typical Nini kid, you know. His mom was a drunk and kind of didn't have anything, you know, together. And he was on the street. His dad left him. And so he started getting into trouble, you know, typical teenager. And he started doing drugs, et cetera. And his sister, thank God, saw this article about the Azteca Youth Orchestra. And he was really into music. He's one of these natural musicians. And she took him there, and now he's obsessed. He re-entered school. He's 15 years old. He's the best player in the band. And he's got a solo in the orchestra. And he's an inspiring person. You know, you meet him now, and they say, you know, 9 months ago, this kid wasn't even the same person. And now he's really respectful, and he's got a whole other outlook on life because he has something to do to make himself feel better, you know. And even if they're not necessarily someone who's going to become a musician, they still are giving them that discipline that those kids need in their life. They're filling their day with something rather than sitting on the corner, you know.
Photojournalist Dominic Bracco is my guest. We're talking about his work covering the Mexican drug wars in Juarez, Chihuahua. If you want to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. Let's go first on the phones to Drew in Irving. Hi, Drew.
Hi, Chris. Dominic, this is Drew Campbell. I just want to say I'm really proud of all that you do. But I wanted to ask if you think, what about the importance of covering basically domestic war photography as opposed to going overseas to the Middle East?
Could you repeat the question?
How do you think the importance of covering basically domestic war photography is compared to, say, overseas in Iraq or Afghanistan?
Well, Drew, I think that both are important. I think that, you know, there's photographers in the Middle East doing amazing work, and it's an important story as well. But Mexico is kind of a story that I feel closer to than the Middle East. I mean, growing up on the border, obviously. So as a person who's interested in covering violence, I think that it's a natural fit, I guess. And I there's not a whole lot of photographers from the U.S. working in Mexico. And so I think it's important that, you know, we're out there doing it.
How obvious is the presence of not only the police force, but now you also have the Mexican army in Juarez? I mean, are they everywhere that you look? Where do you see them?
You don't see the military as much because in April 2010, they swapped them out with the federal police, mm-hmm. which is basically looks like the military. They just wear black instead of brown. But there was a lot of human rights issues with the military, and people wanted them out. But you still see them driving around, and then you see the federal police now who are armed to the teeth, you know, driving around patrolling
streets.
Are they
making a difference?
No. I have a friend who's a local journalist in Juarez, and he jokes that they're there to protect the gun shells. So they go in, and what they do is they secure the perimeter of the deaths, and they write down how many bullets have been shot, and that's what they do.
Nobody gets arrested?
No, not really.
Because there's no will?
I don't know if it's because they're scared or corrupt or what. I just know that there's never really any arrests that are being made. No, I mean, of course, they've had some operations and got some kingpins, right? I mean, they always announce that stuff on television in Mexico. But when you see the daily street violence and the people that are just getting killed, and, you know, there'll be military sometimes right down the street and nothing happens. You know, they'll show up and secure the perimeter and take down their notes, and that's what they do.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Jesus in Fort Worth. Hi, Jesus.
Hi, I just wanted to applaud Mr. Bracco's efforts for being courageous and going to Mexico to cover this, you know, very dangerous place. And what people often don't realize is how much of an impact what happens in Juarez has on us here in the States. I grew up in El Paso. I live in Fort Worth now, but I grew up in El Paso, so I have family there. You know, have had relatives that have been killed because they didn't pay the quota. My parents went over to Juarez one time and had their truck stolen over there when they were just, you know, over shopping. So I think it's very important that photographers like Mr. Brock are courageous enough to go over and, you know, report on what's going on in Juarez. I'd be very curious to hear from his perspective, you know, what either we can be doing in the United States to help end some of that violence. Obviously, you know, being voracious consumers of the drugs that lead to the violence, that's one area. But, you know, what other things can we be doing, you know, people either in El Paso, on the border, Texas, you know, the United States, to help end that violence, which does impact us on the border and impacts our country as a whole.
Jesus, before we get an answer from Dominic for you, I have to ask, do your parents still go to Juarez regularly?
Since their car was stolen over a year ago, my mother has not set foot in Juarez, which is, it's very, very sad because, you know, they were born and raised in northern Mexico, in Chihuahua, and so it's very sad that, you know, we don't even go over there. And, you know, to comment a little bit on what Mr. Bracco was saying earlier about people becoming desensitized, it really is such a sad, you know, I hear sort of jokes, you know, talking to one guy there recently. He said, I live in Antarctica. I wake up every morning, you know, -8, -9. And he doesn't mean -9 degrees. He means -8, -9 people. Hmm. So it's the desensitization, or people become desensitized. It's such a sad thing for such a pretty place where the free flow of commerce was, you know, a major source of revenue for El Paso businesses, for Mexican businesses, you know, the exchange of commerce and people moving back and forth. I think some of that has really stopped, and it's so sad.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks, Jesus. I think that, for one, you're right. I think that people in the States really do need to be held accountable for one, their consumption of drugs. You know, even marijuana, people often say, oh, it's just marijuana, you know, I'm just smoking a joint or whatever. But the fact is that, you know, there's kids on the streets dying in Juarez, so you can, you know, roll your spliff. And people, they don't want to think about that. They don't want to think, you know, oh, I'm buying it here from my local drug dealer. It's all good, man. But the fact is that if you're buying it, especially if you're buying it in this area, it's probably coming from Juarez. And that's what they're using to fuel this war. Also, I mean, all the guns that go into Mexico from the United States, I mean, the level of corruption in the states is obvious, too. I mean, in New Mexico, there was a whole town. I was on assignment for the Wall Street Journal, and we were investigating this this town where in Columbus, where they had been smuggling, hundreds of guns into Mexico, and it was corrupted all the way up to the police chief and the mayor. And so I think people need to really hold U.S. officials accountable and have them take an interest in policies and on the border, but also take an interest in policies, with the maquilas and the factories. They need to have U.S. businesses should be held accountable for creating this sort of environment. I mean, they're paying these people slave labor wages and taking jobs out of the United States to do it. And so no one's really gaining anything from all of this. You have people in the U.S. who are losing their jobs in Indiana or Iowa, and then now they're, just feeling the same fire in Juarez, and the people are accepting these horrible wages because they're starving to death.
My guest this hour is photojournalist Dominic Bracco. He's a recipient of a Pulitzer Center grant for crisis reporting. We'll resume our conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to join us, give us a call at 1-800-933-5372. We're also accepting emails at think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with photojournalist Dominic Bracco. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Jarrett in Dallas. Hello, Jarrett.
Hi. I'm a photographer myself, and I'm actually very interested in the issues in Mexico and Central America. And I was curious about the level of safety you felt while you were there, or whether or not you felt that maybe the stance you were taking wasn't necessarily condemning enough to put you in danger.
I think there's a reality that anytime you step into a dangerous place like Juarez, you're taking a chance, and that's just a matter of you assessing the value of your work and the importance of what you're doing and then the risk that you're taking. So I feel like when I go out and work on Juarez, I have a very specific plan at what I want to do. I don't just go around and shoot, aimlessly. I have a very specific goal in mind, and so I think that outweighs my security. And
how do you know who to trust?
Well, I work with fixers. I work with two local journalists who are fantastic guys, and we go through their network of things. So, for example, I knew I wanted to start with kids. So you just report it. You go, well, let's find someone who works with kids, and so you go from them. You call them up, and they take you around, and they introduce you to somebody, and they introduce you to somebody, and so you kind of just use that natural network,
like a sort of daisy chain from one thing to the next.
Exactly. You can't just go. I mean, Juarez isn't a place where you can just go walk around and say, hey, you, can I
interview you?
Yeah, I may interview you and take your picture and hang out all day, but I mean that doesn't work, And it takes a long time. I've been working on this project for 18, 19 months now, so it's not like something that happens overnight. The first 2 months were so frustrating, there was times where I thought about giving up, but I just kept going, and, every time reconnecting with the same people and kind of going from their friendships so that I could, you know, take the pictures that I felt like I needed to take. And a lot of them now, I don't focus so much on the kind of violence that we were talking about earlier. I focus a lot now on kind of daily life and what it's like to be there and live there, because I feel like those are the kind of pictures that allow people to empathize more with the scenes of violence. You know, these are normal people, and that's what I want to show. And so so that outweighs the security to me. And I think about what I'm doing very specifically so that I can do it in the safest way possible. And I talk to my friends and local journalists and whoever I can and say, do you think this is crazy that we're going to do this? And you go from there.
We have an email here from Kamyar who wants to know, how has what you're doing affected your personal life?
It's changed me for sure. I think I value life more. And, you know, when you see, you know, stupid family feuds or things like that, it makes you think, wow, what is this all about? Like, mm-hmm. What's the point in it? There's no reason. But it does take a small emotional – I mean, well, it does take an emotional toll on you when you do it a lot. I have the fortune of being able to leave Juarez, unlike journalists that, you know, they stick it out every day for the last 3 years of the war. So I'm able to take a step back, and I make sure to do that as much as I can and look at it with fresh eyes each time I go. So, yeah, it's changed, and it makes it hard sometimes maintaining – relationships and stuff, but being on the road all the time, but it's rewarding in so many other ways. And I have friends there that are some of the best friends I could ever have, you know, and they're great people, amazing people, and they're inspiring. And so it's changed my life for the better.
You're based out of Mexico City now?
I live in Mexico City.
Okay. What is the perception there of what's taking place in Juarez? In the same way, we forget that other countries have the same issues where they have kind of like stereotypes of different mm-hmm. parts of the country. Are people following this closely? Are they worried that this kind of violence will spread further into the interior?
Well, it is spreading further into the interior all over. But Mexico City is like this weird, isolated place of security. And people are disconnected from it. I mean, they are more connected to it in a way because most of them have family that live in the provinces, but they still are kind of like, oh, it's going on out there, and they choose to forget about it. It's human nature to not pay attention, I think. But yeah, I mean, it's spreading everywhere across the whole country.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Augustine in Fort Worth, or maybe it's Augustine in Fort Worth. Hello.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thank you.
Well, my name is Augustine. I live in Fort Worth. I was born in Mexico City, and I was in the Army, Mexican Army, for 3 years. I know the insides of what is going on there, but one of the things that I heard lately is that Carlos Slim, the richest man in the world, was going to implement a NSA type of security by registering all cell phones in Mexico to get to track all the setups and all the other cartels. I don't know if that ever came to fruition, but it's a good project, I guess, to regain control over an outlaw state. And just to finalize, there was a Secretary of Education, or I don't know if it's Lopez Velarde, that said a very beautiful phrase, a sentence that says, "Poor Mexico, too far away from God and too close to the United States. We are the biggest producer of weapons, we are the biggest consumer of drugs, and we can print $100 bills at 1,000 bills a minute." So I don't know if that is also augmenting the crisis in Mexico. So that's my comment. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you, Augustine. Yeah. Yes, I think that the proximity to the U.S. definitely hurts Mexico as much as it helps it. But Carlos Slim, he did implement a plan where they're now registering all these phones in Mexico. So if you want to get a cell phone, and each time you want to go buy your SIM card for your telephone number, you have to register your name and show your... So, for example, I have a visa to live there, so I have to have the visa, social security number, and all that kind of stuff. And if you don't have it, then you can't get a phone. But I don't know how much that I mean, I'm sure it's probably helped in some capacity, but I don't know how much or how they're monitoring it or what. I don't know that much about it.
It sounds like it could work. On the other hand, if it fell into the wrong hands, that kind of information, it could be even more devastating.
Right. I don't know.
Let's speak once again on the phones at 1-800-933-5372. This time we'll speak to Gabriel in Plano. Hi, Gabriel.
Hi, Chris. First of all, I would like to tell you that your program is fantastic and you always are talking about topics that are very important for all of us. I'm Mexican, too. And, of course, it looks like we're all Mexicans here like this. Let's pretend, I'm going to make an analogy pretty quick. Let's pretend that the United States have a party and they and all the people that bring the beer have to go to Mexico to get into the party. Mm-hmm. So lots of drug smugglers from all over Latin America, of course Mexico, have to go through Mexico to reach the United States. But that's a big problem for Mexico and for the economy and for the society. For every dead person that in Mexico, there is a family behind. So, of course, there is a huge problem of more poverty, more misery. I would like to ask, and at first I would like to congratulate and encourage this young man that is being so courageous to be reporting this, all this stuff. And I would like to ask him, what does he think is the biggest problem of Mexico now? And what would be his perspective or solution for this biggest problem?
Thanks so much for your call and your kind words, Gabriel.
Thank you, Gabriel. I would say two things. One would be obviously corruption, and I think that the strategy for Mexico's military to go in and attack the cartels like a military hasn't been working because of the level of corruption on all branches. But there's no investigation being done. There's no one's going to court. There's no judicial system. And I think that if there was serious judicial reform in Mexico and they took that seriously and investigated these kind of crimes instead of just going in with guns blazing, I think there would be a change in the attitude of the government, and the people would probably have more respect for the government. And also, I think that they would be a whole lot more effective at keeping the violence down. The other thing, I think, is distribution of wealth. People in Mexico aren't paid enough to work, and they have a lot of problems, with implementation of NAFTA. Small farmers, it's really hard for a small farmer in Mexico to compete with large farms in the United States. Their products sell more expensively in Mexico, and so they, don't have the same level of sustainability that they had before, and it's difficult for them. If you're a factory worker, you don't make enough to live a good life, and so, but then at the same time, they have the richest man in the world, Carlos Slim, and so there's obviously money. There's tons of resources in Mexico, tons of potential. People are amazing. It's a beautiful country. It just isn't really – it's not taken advantage of because people are taking advantage of other people all the time in the country. So,
how has the city been affected, not even strictly by the violence, but by the fact that over the past year and a half or 2 years – it seems as if, and this is an overstatement, but almost everybody who can afford to get out has left.
I don't know if it's an overstatement. It's pretty true. you see businesses close everywhere. I read a statistic that said there was over 10,000 small businesses closed.
And all the jobs with them.
And all the jobs with them. So you have all the intellectuals leaving. Anybody that has money to leave leaves the city. I mean, of course, there's a few people that have chosen to stay behind because it's their home and they feel, like, dedicated to the city. But thousands and thousands of people have gone to El Paso or elsewhere in Mexico. And there's a real sense that the people that are left behind are the poor and the forgotten.
When you finish a shoot and you go back and you start in on the sort of editing process, do you have to relive all those emotions again?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes it's really hard. I try to take a step back from it to go back and look at it again. When I'm shooting, I'm very focused. So I try to empathize as much as I can so it comes through with my pictures. And so I really try to focus on the emotions that are going through. And it's kind of exhausting. Then when I get back and edit, I'm able to kind of disconnect a little bit when I'm editing. But once I start getting down to my final pictures, it really starts to, it can be a little bit emotional. Even today, I mean, I've looked at my pictures hundreds of thousands of times. Mm-hmm. And walking into to the UTA campus and seeing all those big prints on the wall, and kind of, I was actually emotional because it was, I mean, those are real people on the wall, you know, and I was there for all of it.
Yeah, they're not archetypes. You remember the human beings involved.
Right.
Can you tell us a little bit about what is in the exhibition?
So the exhibition is mostly kids. It's a, because it's what I focus on. But you'll see a lot of pictures of daily life and, you know, to have pictures from a quinceañera and a family birthday party and a couple kissing on a couch and all these sort of daily life things that we all cherish. But then you'll also see horror, you know, horrible things. There's the picture of the couple in the car, the blood on the doorstep and the car where they executed police officers, and some pictures that I feel kind of like bring the mood of what it's like to be there and live there. So I'm trying to take you on this journey of what it's like to be a person growing up in Juarez.
Because that's daily life, too.
Because that's daily life, too.
And tomorrow, your talk, you will give a slideshow as well, or show film?
I'm going to show the little film. I don't want everything to be all doom and gloom. So with funding from the Pulitzer Center for Crisis Reporting, I worked with a colleague of mine, Susana Siejas, who's a freelance producer in Mexico City. And we went to Juarez, and we did a story about a kid, Esteban. So it's an inspirational piece.
All right, great. Dominic, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for being here.
No, thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.